It's another very special soundtrack in this week as we take you to the Everyman Cinema in Hampstead, where director Alex Garland and his composers Jeff Barrow and Ben Salisbury came together for a Q&A following our exclusive screening of Annihilation. As you may know, the film hasn't had a cinematic release outside the US. You can, however, watch Annihilation on Netflix, and it is well worth your time if you haven't seen it already. Now, before The Boss joined us on stage, I caught up with Jeff and Ben in the bar to discuss their other work, specifically on Alex's Ex Machina and Ben Wheatley's Free Fire. Their first score together was for Dread. At least it would have been, had the studio not decided it wasn't suitable for the film. Thankfully, they shared their efforts anyway under the guise of Drock, and it's with a spot of Drock that we begin as we find out how they met. Set the scene first, actually. We've just introduced the film Annihilation at the Everyman here in Hampstead, and Jeff Barrow and Ben Salisbury and I are just sitting in a little room chatting, and I thought we'd chat about you guys and your work together and also individually as well before Mr. Garland joins us later on for the actual Q&A. I want to know how you two met for the first time first.
We play the worst possible competitive old man football. We're in a league, and it's actually it's the 28th tier of the English league. So there's 28 leagues beneath the sea.
Yeah, it's basically terrible. We play terrible football. Yeah, it was about 15 years ago we both started playing football in this terrible. You can tell how terrible it is because by the names of the teams in the league. Our team is called Bayern Munich.
There's Real Madras.
Yeah, it's, that gives you some idea. Yeah, so we played football together for about 5 years before we even knew each other did music.
Wow.
I didn't know Jeff was in Portishead. I obviously knew of Portishead. I'd grown up in Portishead. But I didn't know he was Jeff from Portishead, and he didn't know I did music at that time. I was doing music for Natural History Films.
I knew it was like a bunch of media types.
Favourite.
They had media names.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like Tristan and...
Yeah. And I didn't.
And he didn't. So I think that's why we ended up chatting.
Then I did find out it was Jeff from Portishead eventually after we talked bad football in the bar, but eventually we were talking music and I was asking to clear some samples for a friend of mine and I knew Jeff would know the answer, and so we just got talking more music and I ended up doing some string arrangements for bands on your record label.
Yeah, I think first talk about us working together, I was the music supervisor for the Banksy film Exit Through the Gift Shop, and I kind of got roped into that, not really ever wanting to do anything with film because I always thought it was beyond me, really. So I spoke to Ben because we were thinking about getting a school orchestra to play something terrible and how we would go about it, and we spoke over a couple of pints and it never worked out. You know, then Ben did some arrangements on the Malachi album, did Joe Volk on Invader, and we just kept on chatting. And then...
Yeah, it was just about waiting for the right time for the right project to come up. We both said, I was sort of stuck is the wrong word, but I didn't want to be doing natural history. I desperately wanted to be doing feature films or dramas of any sort. Jeff was doing his stuff, but wanted to try and get into writing film music, and we just thought, well, maybe we might be able to both help each other out here.
Yeah, it was really quite simple. It was really that simple. I mean, because film composing, I think, is two main things. It's understanding the language of film composition and where it goes and the temperature of it and the underscore and, how powerful it can be and how emotive it can be. And then the other side of it is the actual sound and how experimental it could be and how incredibly normal it can be. And I think... between us, we both realised that actually we both know, a fair amount about either side of it. And that's what really kind of, you know, drove us together. And but big, we got on.
And the big opportunity was Dread, which was Alex's Alex's film that he directed. And Jeff went up to meet him because Alex had found out that Jeff was a fan of 2008.
It was a guy. It was Richard Russell, who runs XL Records. He is a very good old friend of Alex's.
He was going to be here tonight, but he's gone. It's his birthday, and he's going to see Hamilton.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, yeah. Well, that's probably kind of.
I would say he's got the wrong choice.
No, he can watch Annihilation on Netflix.
Yeah, he can watch on Netflix. So, yeah, it was weird because he called me up and said, look, a friend of mine, I hadn't heard of Alex before. I hadn't read The Beach. Because I was considered The Beach to be this kind of thing about kind of traveling kids that were kind of in Thailand and the opposite of what I was really.
I was one of those kids and did read The Beach.
This is where this partnership is just the perfect thing. You're like the complete polar opposite.
No, but actually, we're incredibly similar.
We went to the same underage nightclubs in Bristol.
Absolutely. Most of us snogged the same people.
Oh, come on.
kept it modern, you know. We spoke to Alex, and then Dread was happening, and because I was a massive 2000 AD fan, it was like, oh my god, the first film I'm going to do is this thing that I've dreamt about, because reading 2000 AD inspired me into writing music, that and alongside, you know, kind of Public Enemy or that kind of stuff at that time was so important. And so to be given the opportunity to do it was amazing. And I had an idea, you know, and we talked about it and we both agreed.
Well, I went into Jeff's studio and he brought this particular synth and he played me something and I was like, this is just brilliant, perfect. God, I'm doing natural history stuff with orchestras, which is great, but I just want to be doing this. And so we set about doing it and we did some demos for it. And it, I mean, the story's been told, but it didn't work out because... Lionsgate essentially thought they were getting an action superhero film, and they ended up getting at a certain point in the edit realised they were getting a sort of art house film with a very strange demo score, and they asked for it to be changed in lots of ways and it happens, you know, we've since learned this happens all the time. And in our sort of naivety, we said, well, no, we can't really change it.
And Paul also
did that, though. It feels like there was no other option.
There were 100,000 2000 AD fans. Like, if I was responsible for the musical side of it being absolute crap, then I just couldn't deal with it under, you know, and the band I was in and the way I've always been with music is I just won't do that anyway. So,
But it also is to do with the approach. The particular approach that we'd taken, it had no other option. There is loads of ways you can write music, which has loads of options and loads of ways you can take it. This didn't. It was sort of binary. It was either this or something
very
else.
Pure.
And I mean, you know, it's
you can hear it.
It's
drop.
An album,
you know,
yeah,
it's,
I mean, that's the thing. We've got this album. Yeah. That's the brilliant thing about the good, you know, the happy ending to this story.
Yeah,
is that as music fans
and
as film fans and the original fans of the series, you've got this. Fantastic.
And
piece
Alex
of music.
Still got to make Dread, and it's a fantastic film, and it ended up having a great score. But we couldn't have done that score or done the music to the film with the way we'd started. So, in some ways, it really did work out for the best because we formed a relationship with Alex, and he just said, look, you know, next time when I'm really, you know,
got control,
I want you on board, and I want you on board early.
Yeah. But even with that whole project with Dread, there's like, you know, there's still, he's not credited as a director of it as well. There's still that whole kind of, you know, it's like...
He was a director of it.
Well, that's what I mean. It's like, but there's just this weird kind of cloud around the whole thing anyways.
Yeah, it was. When we joined it, he had directed it and he was editing it. That's our side of that, you know. and also we ended up actually giving, there was a specific effect that we used for the slowdown of the drug, you know, that they used, because it was such a, you know, we stumbled upon it, but it was, it worked really, really well. So our mark is kind of in there, and it is a really good film.
First project that you worked together on, was that relationship and that working relationship instant in terms of
yeah.
we complement each other or we work well together?
Yeah, I mean, we're
very much so. Yeah,
we're from very different musical backgrounds on paper, but actually, sort of not really. We're exactly the same age. We, you know, went to schools that used to have fights with each other in the playground, and you know, had the same musical upbringing in different musical
upbringing. What was the album that we absolutely bonded on? It was Howard Jones, Human Live, wasn't it?
Yeah, things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We knew the words.
We got all these synths for Drop, and we ended up mostly playing Howard Jones on it. Well, seriously, in terms of films, you know, the John Carpenter thing and you know, Morricone,
well, yeah,
and all the,
yeah,
you know, all of that, it, all we, the... that world was similar. But then we also had our own take on things. You know, I had a pretty standard sort of musical upbringing. Well, I didn't do music O-level or A-level, but I then went to university and did a music degree and all of that. So I've had a sort of what you call classically trained, although that, I think that's such a bullshit phrase. Yeah. But, you know, I know that world, and Jeff's been in the Porter's Head world, you know, so we have different things to bring yeah. to the
but
table.
We both agree is usually it's like less is more, and if you can find one thing to do something, then that's enough. Unfortunately, a lot of composers are put under pressure to kind of make things bigger, or you know,
I've had it, you know, in the natural history programs where it's like, you know, what do you want me to get in here, cannons, or you know, how can it be bigger, it's just some grass growing, you know?
Which is, you know, the Transformer film, that kind of, that, as soon as that was done, it was kind of, you're there. So, you know, and it's like in Ex Machina when Caleb cuts his arm open, it's just like two synths. Thank you. think that language is dying out. But I mean, our main thing is to keep on moving on. We don't want to be like in the same pot as everyone else. We want to keep on doing, you know, interesting, unique scores, you know.
You mentioned Alex with Ex Machina. It was like getting you in early, and that's kind of how it's continued. How early were you in there?
Alex gave us the script as soon as he'd written it and said, what are your thoughts on it? He then met Jeff weirdly in an airport.
Yeah, in Sweden. Yeah, we were, Paul Zed were playing, and Alon was actually being rude to the woman behind the counter at the cafe. I thought, I recognise that bloke. He's from London. And then Alex was there. I was like, all right. He's like, what are you doing here? And they were scouting for the Ex Machina houses, you know.
Nathan's house,
you know.
Wow.
And it was like, right, let's get together soon.
You know? That's the job I want, is like scouting for places
in
like
a helicopter.
That
from... Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, we read the scripts. As soon as there was a rough cut, just a first assembly, we came in. That is the way we work with Alex. It's probably the way... If we do stuff with him in the future, it's set a pattern, which is insanely difficult, but creatively satisfying, because you're there from the, you know, I know there's a whole lot of stuff that goes on in a film before they even start shooting, but to be there from when they first start editing and the journey that a film goes on, and if you can be, as a composer, part of that team.
A lot of composers can't, though, can they?
Because... No, I know. We're massively overstepping our brief in some ways. We get involved in the whole journey of the film.
It's really weird because you get, like, Rob, the DOP, and the producers and Alex. And, you know, when it goes into kind of post-production, you know, it's been shot. And you've been doing it for a long time. And I think if you're a composer just kind of getting knockbacks, and then most probably feel really bad. But what happens is we go in... And we watched the new cut of it or whatever with Barney, you know, the editor, and Jan, the music editor, and Alex, and us two. And it's really interesting because Alex is open to anyone to say anything about the film. So it's like, that new edit doesn't really work. You know, and you're the composer saying, that new edit doesn't really work there. And he's like, oh, yeah, no, I know. Oh, it's interesting.
Yeah. And what will then happen, that will send a whole pack of cards tumbling. Normally... Yeah. To our disservice in some ways. So, a good example is Ex Machina, where we were three quarters of the way through, I think, and had a viewing of the whole, which we do regularly throughout the thing, view the whole thing and sort of take stock and see what was working.
Micromanaged. I mean,
I think it was Alex that obviously was the strongest voice in this, but he thought, you know, Caleb's falling in love with this robot too soon. Surely he'd be a bit freaked out by her. I mean, he's supposed to be infatuated with her from first sight, but also this is a robot. And so we'd completely written this strand of music that was Caleb's infatuation with the robot. And we all decided, well, this is he's falling in love with her too early. We've got to change the first one and make it a bit stranger. There's no other way of doing it. We can't get the actors in again, you can't change the script. The only thing we've got at our disposal is editing, you can do that with, but music is the easiest and the most effective way of doing it.
Yeah.
So we changed that first cue. The next one, because that was where
it's like
the temperature,
it's like a domino effect.
That,
you know,
whole
I mean?
Strand, months of work just fell apart from that. So that's quite a good example.
And it's really weird actually, because you listen to it and it just seems like that we're just pissing about on a couple of synthesizers.
Which is what
we do. Of course you
wouldn't. Yeah. But it's kind of, honestly, you wouldn't believe, it's just like there'll be this one noise and then that'll move to six places in like 3 months. Like there'd be huge rows. I mean, they're literally proper rows in the edit suite about where it should be.
Yeah.
You're preempting the action. You're preempting the emotion. But it's really funny, you know what I mean?
But the whole joy of being, you know, being involved in that sense of, you know, the minutiae of it. Both of us, I think, grew up wanting to do music, but also to be. I could never be a filmmaker, but I sort of part of my brain wants to be.
Yeah.
And we sort of are. I think it's the doing music for an Alex film. You really feel like you're a filmmaker.
You're part of
in
it.
The broadest sense.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's
it is.
Yeah.
He is Dr. Evil. You know what I mean? It's just you ain't gonna get anything past it. You know what I mean?
He'll probably talk loads about collaboration and everyone's opinion.
But
tonight,
literally, no. But it's done in such a brilliant way. You just accept it. You just kind of go, well, I absolutely trust this person to know.
But it makes it hard. You build up a pillar and you knock it down, and the whole thing starts crumbling. And you've got to, you've got to find another way of doing things. And so, for every Alex film, you know, if there's anyone out there who wants offcuts of Alex Garland films, we could score like 20 films with Alex Garland offcuts.
I mean, the whole thing is, I think we're lucky in a sense. A lot of jobbing composers, it's just like, there's your 3 months. This is it. This is what kind of we want. And also, they're not, you know
and there's a temp score, and it's just, replace the temp score with something.
Yeah.
A bit similar.
Yeah.
Whereas we make the temp score with Alex, you know, and we then replace our own temp score, and then
five times.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about Annihilation properly in there, but just quickly on Ben Wheatley, who has been on this podcast twice, and he's just the nicest man.
Oh,
talks so highly of working with you guys.
Oh, it's brilliant.
What was that experience?
Free Fire was a really good experience, wasn't it? We couldn't have wished for a better thing after Ex Machina, which was very involved and in some ways, although it wasn't, lots of the stuff was brought in, but it was very minutiae on the computer. This was, we did it as a band.
Yeah.
And for me, I'd never been in a band. I'd been in a band as a teenager. You know, we formed a sort of bad pub prog rock band.
Yeah, the idea was that we were going to be like a Belfast pub prog band.
Yeah.
I mean,
magically made a sort of fairly dodgy record that fitted Ben's film that he found in a secondhand record shop.
There's two sides of it. There's the more traditional kind of Lalo Schifrin style cop kind of shoot 'em up movie stuff that we did. And then there's the really wobbly chorus prog, 12-string guitar kind of stuff. And it was really good. I mean, we got, you know, Clive from Portishead and Radiohead played a load of drums.
Yeah.
And Ross. We pulled in a lot of really good players, and Bill. You know,
did you play any live shows?
Well, we would love to have done. It would Free Fire didn't take off in the way that any of us sort of really expected. But I think maybe it will have a second wind, and if it does have a second wind, which it completely deserves,
festival billing written all over it. Surely
it'd be brilliant to
you.
But he does it all the time. For me, it would be brilliant. Yeah. I didn't get to do this.
I play pub prog for a living.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It would be. You know what, it was great. I mean, it was a low budget film, but it didn't look it. And who's the amazing sound guy?
Oh, Martin Pavey.
Yeah,
just,
I mean,
incredible.
He is a one man army. He literally is the sound recordist.
Well, he was involved in that, but then he was dubbing mixer, he was the sound designer, the amount of gunshots in that film, it's like a symphony of gunshots.
It truly took the
pressure off us as composers, because we had a screening of it at Channel 4
this
we'd written any music, or we'd done some demos.
Actually, we said they didn't fit.
They were good demos, but
no, they're really good if you hear them alone, but they were just far too pompous and American. So it was like, what are we going to do? And it's like, okay, we're going to show it to Channel 4 with no music whatsoever. We're just going to use a couple of the soundtrack,
John Denver,
the drops on it, and needle drops, and then and that was it. And they watched the whole film, and it didn't need a score. It was amazing.
just with Martin's gunshots and the needle drops, and we just thought, actually, we're in a really good position here. We can. It's working without our help.
First worked with my guests with High Rise and the reworking of the ABBA track with Portishead, which was just, I mean, spellbinding, just incredible. Did it take much persuasion to do that?
I honestly can't remember. I think I was talking to Ben, and then Ben came down to Bristol, met me and Aid, and then mentioned about the ABBA track and High Rise, which for me was like, along with 2008, I'm just one of those kind of people that digs that stuff. And really, it was quite quickly put together, really, as a demo. And poor old Ben, you know, he came down to, I don't know, poor old Ben, he's amazing, but he came down to Bristol in front of me, Aid, and Beth, and Debbie, who works for us, and played like the assembly cut of it, which was 3 hours long or something. We watched it, and Beth, if you can imagine the opposite of 2000 AD, that's Beth.
Yeah.
So we watched it, and our track started. And obviously, it's over the rape scene. And we knew nothing about this. And we were like, right, okay. that's a really odd kind of concept to put like our version of SOS over the top of this incredibly hard rape scene. And it went a bit quiet in the studio. And then we got chatting and it was fine after that. But it is a very heavy, it's a very heavy scene. Yeah, and it was good fun doing taking an ABBA song and twisting it.
Yeah.
And also because Bjorn really liked it as well. So that's a huge bonus in itself, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. Right, go eat, and I'll see you on that stage in a bit. Cheers.
Okay, cheers.
Cool.
Where are those happy days? They seem so hard to find. I tried to reach for you, but you have closed your mind. Whatever happened to our love? I wish I understood. It used to be so nice, it used to be so good. So when you're near me, darling, can't you hear me, SOS? The love you gave me, nothing else can save me, SOS. When you're gone,
High Rise, that's Portishead's stunning version of ABBA's SOS, rounding off the first part of soundtracking with composers Jeff Barrow and Ben Salisbury. That conversation took place in the bar at the Everyman Cinema before Alex joined us all on stage in front of a live audience to discuss their involvement in the film. Plenty more on that in a moment, but we begin with Alex's thoughts on why Jeff Vandermeer's novel appealed, fittingly accompanied by the cue entitled Annihilation. Ladies and gentlemen, Alex Garland, Jeff Barrow and Ben Salisbury. Listen, congratulations, first of all of you, on an absolutely wonderful, wonderful film. I like nothing better than a film coming out and seeing it, and it kind of inducing questions and it really sparking conversation with people, and that's kind of what I feel like I've done since I first saw it. Can I go back to the book and when it first connected with you?
Producers, one of the things producers do is they have relationships with publishers and they get books before they're published and they fight with each other about who gets the book, and they're basically taking bets on what would be bestsellers, I suppose, and that kind of thing. Anyway, all three of us were in post-production on Ex Machina. We were about halfway through the edit and one of the producers of Ex Machina and this film sent me the book and said, are you interested? And I read it and I thought it was a very interesting novel, had something that I thought was worth trying. So I said, yeah, that was it.
And then when you come to adapt it for the screen, am I right in thinking you didn't really go back to the book? It was more about the...
There was an odd thing about it. So in adapting something, what you have to do is essentially understand or make a decision, even if you don't understand, on what it is you're adapting. This was the third adaptation I'd worked on. One was a sort of literary adaptation novel, Never Let Me Go, English novel, Judge Dredd, English comic book, and then Annihilation was the third. And Never Let Me Go was a rather sort of slavish, literary adaptation, where I was literally cutting and pasting dialogue from the book and staying very close as I could, I think, to the source material. Dredd was adapting the character, and I felt that's what I had to be true to. and the character, the lead character. And in this case, it was an atmosphere. It's a rather sort of dreamy book, and has a dream-like quality as you read it. And what I thought was, it's the atmosphere that I'm adapting. So I did something sort of unusual. I don't know if it was a good idea, but what I thought was, I'm not going to reread the book. I'm not going to highlight things in with a yellow pen and stuff like that. I'm going to adapt it from my memory of the novel. So I read it once and I didn't go back. And that, I don't want that to sound contemptuous of the novel. It wasn't at all. It was to do with trying to understand what it was one was doing.
And have you read the other two books of the trilogy?
I haven't. Because I'm not particularly minded to work on a franchise, and they were not written at that point. I knew they were coming, and I'd then written the script and actually gone into prep. And so I thought, what happens if I read something that unbalances the idea that we were by then all collectively working on? So no, I didn't.
When you were writing the screenplay, do you listen to music when you're writing?
I do listen to music when I'm writing. I was listening I was listening to Beak, Jeff's band. I really was. It sounds sort of sycophantic, but I was.
Was that because you knew you were going to be working with these two on the score? Or?
No. I'm a big fan of that particular band. But actually what happened was, one of the ways we worked together, and there are other people in this collective, and we all work together in the same way. I mean, these guys can talk about it more than me, but composers are often brought in for a 6 to 8 week stint, let's say, towards the very end of post-production. And we started talking about this probably a year before filming. And we were discussing music ideas way, way before shooting. I remember us sitting in the car outside Paddington Station in a side street, just discussing it for ages. But really, you guys should talk about that.
What were those conversations? What were the first discussions you had about Annihilation with Alex?
I think they've even stayed to the final cut of the film. The very first thing you said, I remember it, was, I think we're going to... Well, it was two things, because we had Ex Machina as a reference. Ex Machina was done, and Alex said, this is going to be on a broader canvas, musically, is going to be bigger in all ways. And he just said, and I hear voices in it. I think there's going to be some element of human voice. That was a very simple thing that was a very first thought of yours. That sort of stayed through, you know, completely through the whole time we were doing it.
We talked about kind of human voices being scrambled, didn't we, and thrown around, which kind of happened. I think that the transformation between the very normal beginnings of the film to a head fuck
was
pretty apparent.
Yeah, no, you did say, and it's got to go from suburbia to psychedelia, and it's going to always have this wedge shape.
Thank you. oh, and the other thing you mentioned in that car outside Paddington was, and it's going to have a track at the beginning, and that will be representative of suburban pop music.
Had you already picked that Crosby, Stills and Nash track?
No, for a long time it was a track Jeff had found, which was, who's that lady in Fleetwood Mac?
What's Stevie Nicks?
It was a Stevie Nicks track.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Oh, it was a duet, really beautiful duet she did. Can't remember what it's called. It's fucking great. Is love so fragile and the heart so hollow? Shadow with words impossible to follow. Saying I'm fragile, try not to be. I search only something I can't see. I have my own life and I am stronger than you know. So it was that for a while, and she wanted $100,000.
I'm rightly so.
Sure, yeah, but we didn't
why
have
not?
100 grand.
Because as you said, it's fucking great, so that's why she was.
You should see the size of a pool.
So then how did you end up with Helplessly Hoping, the Crosby, Stills and Nash track? Because you hear it in, you know, with the recurrence of it in film and stuff, it's so perfect.
There's two Crosby, Stills, Nash tracks I really like. It's that one and Guinevere. Mm. And the thing I like about them was that, yes, it had something to do with that suburbia to psychedelia thing, which was a whole principle in the film. It has a whole kind of structure to it. But also, I like both those tracks because they are very, very overtly beautiful. And there's something about people who hedge their bets where, you know, they want it to be beautiful or they want it to be romantic or something, but they slightly pull back. And those tracks just go for it. There's something oddly confrontational about their sort of total, the harmonies. They're also quite odd. They're discreetly odd whilst being very beautiful. So I sort of admired that. Helplessly hoping her harlequin hovers nearby, awaiting a word. Gasping at glimpses of gentle true spirit, he runs, wishing he could fly, only to trip at the sound of goodbye. Wordlessly watching, he waits by the window and wonders at the empty place inside. Heartlessly helping himself to her bad dreams, he worries, did he hear a goodbye? Or even hello? They are one person, they are two alone, they are three together, they are for each other. I sort of thought it sets a kind of intention. What this film does and what Ex Machina does and what all the films I've been part of do is they sort of wear their hearts on their sleeve, I think. And this film wears its heart on its sleeve. It makes it quite easy to react against it. It sort of pushes its subjectivity right to the fore. And that track, I sort of felt, sort of captured that.
It definitely comes with a heaviness. You can use acoustic traditional music, but what they did especially in Guinevere, there's a darkness to it in its tone that makes you feel kind of beauty, but you know there's something behind it. And that gave us a really good basis to start.
It was very useful for us to have it there as a sort of pillar that was solid.
Yeah.
Guinevere had green eyes like yours, milady, like yours. She'd walk down through the garden in the morning after it rained. Peacocks wandered aimlessly underneath an orange tree.
there was that, and there was also the Moderat track that comes in at the end, and those were two there in the film. And
they were the posts.
Yeah, like flagposts, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
Themes, and you mentioned that Moderat track that also kind of starts the kind of electronic side of it. Was that deliberate?
Well, the Moderat track was there from the very first cut of the film and represented, yeah, as you say, a sort of step into the other. Me and Jeff had made a conscious decision. Collectively, we've made a conscious decision that this wasn't going to be an electronic. Ex Machina was a very electronic score in many ways, although it's not really, but that's how it comes across. And we thought, no, this is much more organic. All the instruments we use before the synths come in there are all real instruments, even if they sound like synths. That we only used a lot of a thing called a waterphone that is this weird bowed 70s. Used a lot in 70s yeah. scores as an effect, really.
We all felt the same, didn't we? Because I can remember coming in and you saying, I don't want to hear that kind of dum 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 sound, you know what I mean? And we were like, yeah, no, it's done. We can't do that anymore. Let's move on, you know.
What I'd say, for what it's worth, is that, like, you're talking about the tracks other people did. I just want to acknowledge something just as a structural thing to do with the film, which is that it places, I'm truly not just saying this because the composers are here, it puts an enormous weight on the music. It's got a colossal weight on it, because if you were to just scroll through a lot of films, you would typically see at the ends of films lots of dialogue and lots of intercut musical stings, maybe a theme that has been set up doing a quick reprise later, and this at a certain point becomes like 30 minutes of music, and that's after music before it, but it really at a certain point hands over very fully to the image and the performance, a lot of which is without any dialogue, and the music, and it has to sustain that. And not only does it have to sustain that, it had to do something themically, which was to do with otherness. And that was an incredibly difficult, complicated challenge. And on that 6 to 8 week composer slot, the actual composing, not just talking outside Paddington, but the composing was about a year. And it was rewritten and rewritten and reworked on and that's what you should be talking about, because that was the heavy lifting.
when you watch the film, the music, the vision and the sound are so entwined that you can't imagine one without the other.
And we would be lying if we said it was easy, because it isn't. And Alex knows that, and we know that. It was the same on Ex Machina to a degree, and even more so on this one, that it offers us a chance to be part of the film in a way that I don't think a lot of composers get the chance to be. You know, so from the very first cut, very first rough assembly, we're there as part of a very small team of people. You know, there's Barney, the editor, and Jan McCulloch, the music editor, and us three in an edit suite. You know, and we're part of that. We're not just bolted on at the end. And the difficulty with that is that you write the music for the film 10 times over, and you all make collective decisions that a certain part of it maybe needs to change because of you've come to a decision about the narrative journey that the film's happening. And once you pull that pillar down, everything else following it collapses, and then you've got to start again. And there are so many examples of that on this film. But hopefully, for the right reasons, it's a hard thing, but it's a good thing.
It was really funny, actually. I can remember Alex saying, "This is going to be the hardest thing that we've ever done."
And we went, "Yeah, right.
Yeah, right. Yeah, we did Ex Machina with you, mate. We know."
Yeah.
No, he wasn't lying.
How do you know when it is right? How do you know when to stop?
Yeah, it's still. If I watch it, I've still got things. That,
really?
Yeah, a couple of things. Yeah.
Yeah, you just stop. At a certain point, you just stop.
Yeah.
But also, sometimes it is right. You just say, "Yeah, that's it. Good, done."
Other scores or other films at all in the conversation?
Well, actually, that's a lie, because I think the acoustic guitar thread comes from Crosby, Stills and Nash, but it also comes from a sort of
a
Southern
feeling,
Comfort and films like that, do you think? Or
the Ry Cooder did Southern Comfort.
Yeah, I mean, not a specific film, but a sort of generic Americana stepping into the backwoods type. It just felt right.
Structural thing, the guitar was sort of human, and the voice was organic, and the electronic stuff was other.
Yeah,
one of the things is that when you're making something which has a hallucinogenic or surrealist aspect, I think if it's not grounded in thought and intention, then it's fireworks and masturbation, and it's sort of shallow, and you smell it very, very quickly. I think it seems perfectly likely to me that people would watch this film. They could have all sorts of responses, but one of the responses might be to think, I don't really get what's happening here. But I think they'd probably intuit that there is an intention behind it, even if they don't get the intention. And I think sometimes you watch stuff and you know there's no real intention. It's just like, this is a cool music sting, this is a cool bit of VFX. It doesn't have any content. So all of those things, the instruments, and actually then just spread it across everything. Production design, visual effects. Guy doing the visual effects, Andrew Whitehurst, worked as hard as any of us, and his input was as much as any of us, the DOP, everybody.
Choreographer as well, that scene, can we just talk about that amazing scene at the end with Natalie and Bobby Jean Smith?
Yeah,
the choreographer that you used
it's,
for that.
It's highly complicated thing. The whole film was about that scene for me. That was Sonoya Mizuno playing the humanoid, who was also an Ex Machina. She's a very, very gifted actor, but also a very gifted dancer. Bobby was involved in the choreography, and there was another dancer called Kristen, because Natalie was pregnant. And there is a surprising amount in that sequence, which is not Natalie, it's Kristen. And VFX has planted Natalie's face onto Kristen. And it is amazing to me that nobody ever clocks it, but there it is. And we actually put more time aside for that sequence than any other sequence in the film. And it was something that people wanted to cut, and which was one of the biggest fights was
really?
Over that scene. Yeah, absolutely, it was infuriating. It partly came from a knowledge that narratives end in punch-ups very often, and the punch-up can be a gunfight, or it could be a physical fight, or it could be a courtroom scene with barristers brilliantly outwitting each other, but they're always basically punch-ups. And there's something ritualistic and therefore immediately dance-like about that. And that's sort of partly where it came from. But it was a dance. It was literally a dance. And watching, I want to give credit to Kristen and Sonoya, watching them do it was spectacular. Mm. Absolutely spectacular. And was, for me, the single most enjoyable part of filming and editing and everything that I've ever had. It was like, that's why I wouldn't fucking cut it.
Thank God you didn't.
Thank you.
that moment as well, where she kind of, it's that idea of the, I guess, the weight of her own self, and you can see that in Natalie's face, in that kind of shot where she's...
You know, VFX face, yeah, you can.
Oh, now you've spoiled it.
she did that. She did that.
God, it looked a lot like her. The track, is it called The Alien? Oh, my God, it's great. Can we talk a little bit about that? Because that's...
That encompasses the sort of difficulties in some ways of the whole film, because it was very obviously from the very first, you worked on that quite a lot, even when we first saw it, I think, the very first cut, and it was outstanding even then. It like blew us away even then. You know, Alex talks a lot about and it being a collaborative thing, every part of, and writing the music was incredibly collaborative, because that sequence essentially consists of about six bits of music joined together, and they were some that I wrote, some that Jeff wrote, the electronic stuff, and I did the string stuff, and then me and Jeff obviously talk together and help us each other out on those bits, and then it was put together by Jan, the music editor, and Barney and Alex came up with the decision to actually, we can, you know, those bits, those electronic bits you've done, we can make that into one piece, and that, I'm telling it right, aren't I, Alex, I think?
Yeah.
And it was actually quite a late on decision in the film. It was something else for quite a while.
It's always a very free-flowing kind of, you know, you can have the track from the beginning turns up at the end. You know what I mean? It's you know, it's always like, let's pick this up and stick this at the end. It's like, you always think that these things maybe are kind of like really set in stone really early on. Mm. But it's that thing of Alex's kind of openness to just keep on flipping stuff and trying stuff. The thing is, ultimately, what you're doing, you're all working for the better of the film. That really is what counts, you know what I mean? If you've got to do something 6 times, 12 times, it doesn't really matter. It's just how it's going to work best for the film. We would spend ages getting on set, and then that piece of music would actually end up on a completely different scene.
Yeah.
And just, I've put it, and that would be the call that we would dread the most.
We'd get a phone call in the morning. There was one, I remember, where Alex said, you know that brilliant bit of music you've written for the beginning of the film? We might put that somewhere else, but I've taken the guitar piece and I've put it at the beginning, and me and Jeff just looked at each other and went, you fucking what? And then he said, no, seriously, trust me, we'll send you a quick cut of it. We've just put it over the very beginning, and it's completely not what you'd expect from a sci-fi film. You'd expect a sci-fi film to start with all guns blazing or weirdness or all of that, and we're just going to put our cars on, and we both watched and went, oh yeah,
it works really well.
Well, and it does that thing of not doing exactly what you'd expect. Mm-hmm. Which was in the back of all of our minds all the time, I think, with everything.
If anybody can do anything and say anything for the better of the film, then they do. You know, Alex is open for it, and that's what it makes it a pleasurable experience, however hard it is, really.
Thank you.
go on set much?
We did one day. We did with the bear.
Yeah, we were there for the bear being shot up.
Yeah.
And, did you specifically choose that day?
No, but it was totally brilliant. I mean, it was amazing. Yeah. Guns and everything.
Yeah.
I mean, that whole side of it's just phenomenal as well. The kind of
there was the creation of those beasts.
And
I mean, it wasn't made in CGI. It was a real bear, wasn't it? No. Hang on a sec. No. But I mean, it was a real bear in a sense. I had a guy. The bear was real.
It's a guy in a bear suit.
I just want to say
there was no way in which the bear was real.
No, it was. I mean, it wasn't made in a computer, was it?
It was.
No, it wasn't.
We were Jeff, there, what did you see?
Okay, I took some bad mushrooms the night before. Okay.
There was an animatronic head. There was a very big stuntman, huge.
Yeah.
Who would knock them out of the way and pick up Gina and slam her against the wall, slam her back down, and then there was a latex foam head.
But we saw the bear's face with the
new plastering blood all over the bear's head.
Yeah,
that was the animatronic bear head.
Yeah. It was a real bear. It was a real. I'm like, okay, it wasn't.
It wasn't scary.
Yeah. Wow, it really made a lasting impression on you, didn't it?
Oh, okay. It's not often you see kind of bears with a human skull on the side of its head.
Did you ban them from set after that?
No. We had to sneak in after that.
Stop going on about the bear and stuff like that. But it's a godsend that you get to be involved this early on, as opposed to, you know, Alex mentioned the fact that a lot of the time with composers, they're kind of brought in at the last minute and stuff, and, you know, from talking to...
I think it just makes it a bit... I mean, you know, the business is a really harsh business. I mean, it makes the music industry look like playground stuff. It really does. I mean, people are so vile, you know what I mean? And you just never believe that someone could be that vile, and they are, aren't they, really? And they are. And people would drag, they would do anything to smash you into bits, and it's just, so to have a group of you that has actually got this singular goal to fuck with people's heads, you know what I mean? You know, and get away with it, as you said, you know what I mean? Take that much money and make a mad film, then it's good.
No. Yeah.
Especially if they're horrible.
Can I ask the last question? What were you all doing in a car in an alleyway at Paddington Station?
We were talking about the fucking film. I've told you already.
That was
glib.
But we live in Bristol, so we had to get the train.
He's dropping you off the train station.
Yes.
That's nice.
That's nice.
Thank you all for being here. Thank you so much for coming and talking about
it. Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much. Cheers. Take care.
To Annihilation, that was, appropriately enough, the bear, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking, It Was a Real Bear, with Alex Garland, Jeff Barrow and Ben Salisbury. My huge thanks to all of them for taking the time to talk to us at the Everyman Cinema in Hampstead, London, and to all the staff there for letting us use their wonderful venue and helping us organise the event. We'd like to give a special mention to Jake and Alex and the team at Kimusabi Film for recording the event for us too. Now, we couldn't have brought you this without them, so huge thanks. You can watch Annihilation on Netflix with the score available through our very good friends at Invader Records. There's a Spotify playlist for this show via edithbowman.com, including the Stevie Nicks track that Alex couldn't remember the name of. Jeff very kindly told us it was Leather and Lace afterwards. My website is also the place to find the audience Q&A in which Alex speaks frankly about why his film didn't get a wider cinematic release. Please follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK. And we always say, but please do spread the word amongst your friends if you like what you hear. It's a while since we've had some acting talent on the show, so next up we have the fabulous John Sim. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.